Welcome, welcome to another episode of the Small Chops Podcast. I'm your host, I'm your company, I am your travel guide, I am here with you as we navigate through love, love lost, love in the 21st century, we navigate through identity, we navigate through all of the things that are most important to us, and many of the things that are most important to us, and the things that we don't even think about. That could be very vital to our upbringing, to our understanding of the world, as well as each other. This episode is definitely dedicated to a very, very powerful figure that we lost last week, Gloria Jean Watkins, better known by her pen name, Bell Hooks. Went home on December 15th last week, and this prompted me to look at my notes about one of the books that had a pretty monumental impact on my life. And that book is All About Love by Bell Hooks. I thought that this was not only appropriate, but also serendipitous because of the fact that her book turns 22 years old today. Today, December 22nd, 2021, is the 22nd anniversary of Bell Hooks' book, All About Love. And what I wanted to do is I wanted to break down a couple of excerpts that I pulled from that book in hopes that you will take a deeper dive into it, in hopes that it will not only jar your understanding of what the book was when you read it, but maybe interest you or pique your interest enough to read it for yourself. So come along with me, take this journey, and let's dive into All About Love. Bell Hooks died unmarried. I'm not sure if she was single or not. I don't know if she had a significant other. She died at the age of 69, which I thought was hilarious because a lot of people on the internet were kind of knocking her for being single. And 69 is one of the least single numbers in our culture. And I'm reminded of the skeleton figure in Avengers Endgame. When it was leading Thanos up the mountain or something like that, and it said something to the effect of I lead others to a treasure I cannot possess. And I'm starting to think about that when it comes to, you know, people speaking about love, people speaking about children, people speaking about fortune. Maybe those that don't have access to it can still be heard, can still contribute to the conversation at large. Yeah, they don't have kids, so they don't understand it intimately, but they may still have some very thought-provoking questions that maybe some parents never thought of, right? One of those questions that I've never heard parents ask other parents is, are you prepared to raise your child to be a free thinker or to be a good, employee, right? I think that those are very distinct questions, and I think that those are very distinct lifestyles and ways of understanding how to raise a child. But who am I to ask a parent that, not being a parent myself? So I keep that to myself until it's a little bit more commonplace to share your opinions and to ask questions about a situation that, yeah, you may not be able to have access to. And in the same regard, I think that Bell Hooks was a prolific writer, first and foremost, but also had really deep, intimate understanding of the struggles of love, of the struggles of finding love, of the struggles of maintaining love, and the struggles of loving, history of love. We all have history with love, whether it's with parents, whether it's with significant others, whether it's with dogs, whether it's with just friends, people in school. But there is something missing when you don't have the ability to kind of step back and look at the landscape of love or look at your own desires and see if love fits there and why. So much of our culture, so much of what's going on is dictated to us. So much of, how we look at love is because, for me personally, is because of the Wonder Years. It was because of Boy Meets World. I think those two shows really kind of shaped what I thought the loving experience would be, but I didn't have any firsthand experience at the time, at the age, and I definitely didn't have anybody kind of showing me the way. And so seeing a book like this in my 30s was really healing because it took a step back and talked about love from the parents' point of view, because those are the first people you love as a child. and then moving on from that and trying to reproduce that love in a significant other, or trying to understand what your conception of love is, you know, before you even understand it. So you try loving even before you understand the right or wrong ways of doing so. And all of this is described in Bell Hooks' book really beautifully. The first excerpt I want to get into goes like this. If we have not been guided on love's path for most of our lives, we usually do not know how to begin loving, or what we should do and how we should act. Much of the despair young people feel about love comes from their belief that they are doing everything, quote unquote, right, or that they have done everything right and love is still not happening. Their efforts to love and to be loved just produces stress, strife, and perpetual discontent. And from understanding where our perceptions of love comes from is really healing, because you don't know if it's TV. You don't know if it's your parents. You don't know if you don't take a look at, you know, your interpretation of love or what you hope to achieve when looking for love. You're doing yourself a great disservice. And this was something that was really eye-opening to me, because I didn't know that I was kind of just reproducing the relationship between my mother and myself, which was really tumultuous. And I just didn't understand that the skepticism I had for a partner or for what they say or for what they may be doing had nothing to do with the partner, but it had to do with my history with love, which is, I guess, not the healthiest. You know what I mean? Like, hurt people hurt people. And there are a lot of aloof parents that think they can do things by themselves without having to include, you know, elders or even their own family. Just a lot to uncover there. It's a lot to unpack. But that excerpt struck me because it brought up a couple questions for me. Like, we all know the transformative nature of love, but how many of us know how to cultivate love, whether it's with friends, whether it's with a significant other? How do we know how to grow love? I think that's a really, really important question. And it's not so much the love, but the love between people, right? Because you can't just love on its own. You can really just love through other people. Yeah, you can have a pet, I guess. But really understanding love, really interacting with love involves a partner. And that partnership is really revealing, you know, to ourselves. It reveals a lot of our pasts, of what led us to yearn for love in the first place in many cases. So I thought that was a really good way of kind of starting this off. Like, how do we cultivate that? Who do we get our process from? You know, is it from church? Is it from our grandparents? Is it from our parents? Is it from Topanga and Corey? Is it from, you know, whoever we see outside? Especially these days, there's so many examples of it, right or wrong, that, you know, it's really important to be aware of where you're pulling your examples of love from and what you look to achieve, you know, kind of being able to see, you know, if you can, the other side of the thread, and make sure you're able to decipher what is love genuinely, what is open, what is free love, and what may be manipulation, what may be just for the gram, and what just isn't likely to be reproduced. Another really important question that I started to ask myself as I got a little older is, how do we come to the realization, how or when do we come to the realization that what we learned about love doesn't work? When do we actually look at the playbook and say, hey, you know what, this is a little antiquated. This doesn't really, I don't identify with these methods any longer. This doesn't serve me as it served those before me. Or maybe this is a bastardized version of the love that I'm hoping to attain. But whatever I'm doing now, whatever habits I've developed, whatever strategies to acquire the love that I seek isn't working for me, what do you do then? You know, I guess admittance, or, you know, understanding whatever methodologies you're using isn't effective, that's one thing. But then how do you unlearn that and then move into, you know, a new playbook, move into a new way of interacting with love, or understanding love or cultivating love within your own personal garden? How do you kind of come to terms with that? This next excerpt was really interesting to me because it's one of the only times I wanted to push back on what was written in this book. I agree with almost everything that's been here, and I've learned so much. But in this particular case, I don't know if I'm pushing back on the wording or, you know, the sentiment from what this, you know, what this excerpt says. So Bell Hooks was talking about a person that she had dated. And she goes, he was the type of man described by psychologist Dan Kiley in his groundbreaking work, The Peter Pan Syndrome, Men Who Have Never Grown Up. Published in the early 80s now. Listen to this. Published in the early 80s. The Jacket noted that this book was about a serious social psychological phenomena besetting American males. Their refusal to become men. And I quote, though they've reached adult age, they are unable to face adult feelings with responsibilities. Out of touch with their true emotions, afraid to depend on even those closest to them, self-centered and narcissistic, they hide behind masks of normalcy while feeling empty and lonely inside. Now, all of that I think is very true. I think that there are many people who suffer from this, you know, misalignment of the true self, of being able to express themselves and being able to deal with challenging emotions, especially not just challenging situations. I think all of that is very true. The only part that I had a real issue with is their refusal to become men. Now, I think that that is not true. I think that if anything, boys yearn to be men. Boys are always looking at their, you know, mentors, parents, older siblings, and really can't wait to achieve that status. Really can't wait to make that cross, you know, to get rid of boyishness and to really become a man. And I think we just live in a culture where that is not understood. You don't have a process to make men. And I am from the school of men are made. You know, men aren't born. I think women are born and women become women. You don't have to guide women into their womanness. You only have to kind of be there for them when they have the questions. And I don't know. This is all just conjecture. This is me from the outside looking in. But I understand that it's a very different developmental process when it comes to adolescent boys becoming men. And I think that this is a shame. You know, so many of us that are immigrants in this country, we have parents from cultures that did have this, but unfortunately, those parents, for whatever reason, chose to value what this westernized culture has to offer more than our own indigenous cultures. We lack the process to be more to move into manhood and to put away those infantile desires. Joseph Campbell, who was a historian, God rest the dead, had a prolific interview with a journalist called Bill Moyer. I think the title was like The Hero with a Thousand Faces. And he spoke about an indigenous group in New Guinea. And he called them like a simple culture. And that simple culture had that process of manhood almost built into it. And it went a little bit like, you know, when the son is growing up and he's like 11, 12, 13, getting into adolescent age or getting to like preteen age and a little more trouble for the mother. The mother can no longer handle him. One night the boy is kidnapped, you know, and the mother is a part of the kidnapping. You know, the mother knows what's going on and the village elders know what's going on as well. One of the village elders wears a mask, and the boy grows up with that mask, understanding that mask is like a representation of God or whatnot, but they also have an inherent fear because maybe they liken it to the boogeyman or something like that. So one night that masked figure comes in and snatches the boy from his mother, and the mother cries and wails and says, please don't take my son. But all of this is an act from her because she knows that this is a process of him turning into a man. So he is taken. He's taken into the woods. He's beat up. He's surrounded by more than one masked figure. So these are the gods. And, you know, this boy is just, you know, in immense fear, you know, trembling. He's away from his cocoon, his, what do you call it? From his nest, from his protector, from his first god, his goddess, his mother. And he's really all alone. And he doesn't know what to do. And at this point in the ceremony, these men push that boy to actually fight them, fight against the god, fight against the power that this boy is pretty certain so much more powerful than him. He's, you know, with immense fear, he actually has to, he's pushed to the point of defending himself. And eventually he strikes back at the god, at the masked figures, and they make sure that the boy wins. They make sure that the boy actually subdues the masked figures that he's fighting. And afterwards, the men take off the masks. And so that boy understands that process. You know, it goes from a literal mask and a literal power to a figurative power. And through then, that boy understands that he is no longer a boy, but indeed a man. And that rite of passage is there. There's also another culture, hunter-gatherers. And, you know, when the boy gets to an adolescent age, the boy doesn't become a man until he claims his first, you know, meat animal, you know, for the village. Not only is he providing for the village, not only is he, you know, giving something to the village, but he's taking life. And that loss of innocence when you take life is something that is a transition, is a rite of passage for that boy into manhood. And let me tell you, Western culture doesn't really have any of this. That's why you see professional gamers. That's why you see just a lot of us not being able to transition into that adulthood all that well. It's never more obvious to me than living in Portland, Oregon. And I just saw so many hyper-specialized men who know how to do one thing really, really well, but that's it. The rest of their lives are in shambles. And even those that have partners, significant others, the significant others always, you know, often complain about their boyishness, often complain that, yes, they can make, you know, $200,000, $300,000 a year, but they don't know how to change the oil in the car. They don't know when to pay rent. They don't know how to keep up with their bills. They don't know how to keep up with their hygiene. It's just really difficult for them to function outside of their hyper-specialized area of expertise. So I think that we, as a culture, have a problem with boys not being able to transition to men effectively versus boys' refusal to become men. I just really, really thought it was important to make that distinction. Also found it really, really interesting. David Perrell at Perrell.com has an article called Adulting Slow and Fast. And this article speaks about how we live in a culture where boys are, there's an arrested development, you know? It was really interesting because children are growing up faster than ever. You know, with the internet, with TV, they are impartial to their viewer. So they're going to show hyperviolence. They're going to show hypersexuality. They're going to show all these different aspects of adulthood to children if the children's available to see that. And children are growing up faster than ever. They're losing their innocence earlier and earlier. But on the flip side, they aren't transitioning into adulthood really well. In the article, David quotes Neil Postman. And in the quote, he says, "The behavior, language, attitudes, and desires, even the physical appearance of adults and children are becoming increasingly indistinguishable." And before I read this article, which I think is really, really interesting, you should go check it out on Perrell.com. There are things that I noticed personally. I don't watch the Disney Channel all that much, but the last time I did, I just remember looking at these children trying to be little adults. I remember seeing them not dressed as children. I remember hearing them not talking like children. I remember seeing like the sarcasm on their face or their attitudes. And mind you, these are supposed to be like 8 to 10 year olds. And they are very much trying their hardest to be adults. And I took a little issue with that. You know, I don't want kids' humor to become like childish adult humor, because it can't be adult humor, because adult humor has a little bit more, you know, risqueness, if I could say that. But it was like super cheesy. Just it just it bothered me. It's something that I remember distinctly, because I can't even remember what show I was looking at, but I was just looking at them. And then you'll see an adult come into the frame, and it's usually a guy, and he's usually dolting, or he's usually like hyperactive or something like that. And he's acting exactly like the kids, but older, just an older version of the kids. And I remember Jordan Peterson said, there's nothing worse than an old baby. And I thought that was really interesting. And I don't know if that's a sign of our time. I don't know if that was on purpose. I don't know what's going on to where our culture seems to need children to lose their innocence at earlier and earlier ages and become more like adults while not even knowing how to adult properly. So I took a little issue with when it comes to our culture and blaming boys for not developing, but within a culture that lacks the proper structure for the boys to develop. This excerpt reads, "He remained wedded to the paradigm of sexual difference that had at its root the assumption that men are inherently different from women, with different emotional needs and belonging." Is that antiquated? Has that been proven untrue? I think that we live in a culture where it wants men and women to be as similar as possible. And I agree that, you know, we both need access to the same things. There definitely needs to be more justice, more equity. But we also need to understand that there are fundamental differences between us. Whether it's social, whether it's biological, there are like considerable differences between men and women that I don't think should be kind of overlooked. And I don't know if I'm antiquated because I agree that we do have inherent differences. I think that we have inherent that we are encouraged differently. I think we have different stimuli that I think we have the same stimuli that affects us differently. I think things that we value are considerably different, and you know, they change throughout, you know, over time. Maybe they become more similar as we get older, but I think, you know, from adolescence to that elder 40s, 50s, there are some significant differences that we need to not only adhere, but upgrade if we can, you know, update if we can, but just really understand what we are, not who we are as individual people, but what we are as men and women. Jordan Peterson had a really interesting excerpt about women in high paying jobs and how, you know, for example, a woman that goes, women kill it in school, women kill it in elementary school, women kill it in high school, women kill it in college. And we're seeing the vast majority of colleges and universities have an over 50% college graduate rate of women. And it is, you see the education rates are dropping for boys, even in, not even just university, but in high school and grade school as well. Boys just for whatever reason aren't motivated or aren't performing at the same rate as women. So, you know, women perform excellently, women get into high paying jobs, women excel, but there is a point where working 70 or 80 hours a week just doesn't seem to be appealing to some women, to many women, according to Jordan Peterson. And many of the women that he has spoken to or done research with or on decided to forego those upper echelon jobs, whether they're making, you know, $400 an hour as a partner in a law firm. And they value children, they value family so much more. So I just want to point out those things that I think distinguish men and women. Jordan Peterson says it much, much more eloquently than I did. And you're more than welcome to go check out that and many lectures and excerpts from him on YouTube. This particular one, I think I looked up like high paying jobs and women. And it was maybe like an 11-minute clip, and it talked really, really profoundly. And I think when it comes to truths, they should be simple. You know, all truths are simple. And when you hear him break this down, it seems, for me at least, it was something that I could definitely wrap my mind around. I could see very much happening in my culture, in my society, and just, you know, walking down the street and talking to women and understanding that, you know, as women get closer to 30, their motivations change, their priorities change. And there are certain things that may not have been as important in their early or mid-20s that become more and more important because of biological clocks, because of social conditioning, because of any one of these factors. But we do have to understand that we just have different motivations and we react to those stimuli differently. Bell Hooks had two relationships that she spoke about at length in All About Love, and she compared the two relationships as well. Here she says, "Whereas some people had often seen my older partner's silence as intimidating and threatening, a sign of power, my younger partner's silence was usually interpreted as a consequence of my dominance. Initially, I was attracted to this younger partner because his masculinity presented an alternative to the patriarchal norm. Ultimately, however, he did not feel that masculinity affirmed in the larger world. He did not feel that masculinity affirmed in the larger world and began to rely more on conventional thinking about masculine and feminine roles, allowing sexist socialization to shape his actions. Observing his struggle, I saw how little support men received when they chose to be disloyal to patriarchy." Oof. To be disloyal to patriarchy, to try and find your own way, to look and see, you know, whatever images, representations of masculinity you see in modern media, or not, I guess it wasn't modern. This must have been back in, you know, the 70s, 80s or something like that. But it was really telling to see that last line, especially when she says, "Observing his struggles, I saw how little support men received when they chose to be disloyal to patriarchy." When a man is looking to create his own lane, when a man is looking to still be a man, still be a heterosexual man, whatever his preference is, it is very difficult to explore masculinity. I remember an episode of Insecure where Issa's best friend dated a guy that might have had a homoerotic episode or a time with a friend, and she just couldn't shake that. She couldn't get over that. And she ended up cutting off the relationship because that's just something that she was really uncomfortable with. And from the outside looking in, that seems irregular, but it is very much normal in that culture and that in that part of the world, at least. And I think in the Western culture, by and large, you know, outside of America and America itself, it is very much frowned upon for men to be a little bit more fluid. I guess things are changing now, thankfully, but there was a very rigid way of looking at masculinity. And of course, you saw many people challenge that, you know, entertainers and musicians in the 70s, they definitely don't look like, they don't dress how they dress now. I think of Prince and how masculine Prince was, even though, you know, his masculinity was very rare, but he achieved greatness, you know, with it. And he was very comfortable in his own skin, and choosing what he chose was very rare. You know, I think he was more the exception than a potential rule, but maybe he paved the way for people to be a little bit more free now. In either case, there is a lot of difficulty when it comes to this patriarchy, when it comes to these social norms. And I don't think it's just women that are suffering. I think men are suffering as well. And one of my favorite quotes from Esther Perel, she says, "The lives of women will not improve until the lives of men improve." Like, we're all in this together. We're all suffering, and we're all having a really hard time under this particular cultural domain, I guess you can call it. Recent generation is turning to unconventional masculinity by and large. You're definitely seeing a lot of it, but where are they finding support? Where are they finding, you know, examples? Where are they finding mentorship? And it's really hard to do, so I can't imagine how difficult it is for them to say, no, I don't want to do what, you know, popular culture is prescribing for me, but I don't have many examples, or I don't have much encouragement to go and find or explore, you know, what masculinity means to me. Much like dancing salsa, you must focus on her experience and squeeze out some for yourself if you can. I wrote that as a note because conventionally, when you dance salsa, there is a masculine role, there's a feminine role. And I love that balance because there can't be two leaders, there can't be two followers. One person has to decide to lead, one person has to decide to follow. And when you get good enough, you can switch roles sometimes. You know, the woman can lead, the woman can follow in really, really good dance groups. But I also see that there's an expectation for the man in the in let's say salsa, for a man dancing salsa, there's an expectation that the woman is going to be the center of the show. The woman's going to be the star. You are facilitating her beauty. You are making sure that her moves can accentuate her beauty, right? Her dancing, her professionalism, but her skill. And if you can, if you're a really good dancer, you squeeze out a couple turns on your own. You know, you squeeze out a little bit of flair, a little bit of panache on your own. But the dance is typically focused on the woman and making sure that her experience is a positive one. And it reads, although we all want to know love, we talk about the search for true love as though it is always and only a solitary quest. I am disturbed by the weighty emphasis on self and so much new age writing on the topic and in our culture as a whole. When I would talk about my yearning for a loving partner, people told me over and over that I did not need anyone else. They would say I did not need a companion and or a circle of loved ones to feel complete, that I should be complete inside myself. While it is definitely true that inner contentness and a sense of fulfillment can be there whether or not we commune in love with others, it is equally meaningful to give voice to that longing for communion. Life without communion and love with others would be less fulfilling no matter the extent of one's self-love. Can't agree with this more. You know, it's one thing to say, hey, I'm enough, but it is another thing entirely to deny the fact that you are human and that you want love from another person, that you want love from another, from other people, that you want love from a group, from a community, that you want to belong, that you want to solidify your identity. A couple of questions that I had in regards to this excerpt were, how do we respond to someone's audible desire for love? I know when I'm talking to my homeboys and we're, you know, all talking about being single, they're talking about, you know, having relationship things and things like that. The outward communication of longing isn't readily there. I wouldn't say that we communicate like to our longing for love, but there is a consideration of love and wanting to incorporate in our lives. And I don't think we help each other out with that. Maybe we'll listen to each other's stories and give each other advice, but there isn't a community of lovers that are committed to trying to bring more love into the world. And I don't know if that would work or not, but I know that there are opportunities to be a little bit more, involved in each other's lives when it comes to love and, you know, how we want to live with it and the kind of love that we want in our lives. I don't hear many of my friends tell me the kinds of love they want in their lives, especially the males. I know that there are women that want things from love. And I've heard, you know, many of my women friends tell me about the kinds of love that they've had and the kinds of things that they enjoy in love. But I don't hear so much about men sharing that aspect of love and how the love would increase their lives or increase the value in their lives and or the joy and happiness in their lives as well. So I think that that's a distinction that needs to be discussed and changed for sure. I would love to be able to talk about how I can help my brothers find love, help my brothers that have love cultivate the love that they want, versus just saying, hey, I want, you know, love in my life. Esther Perel has a fantastic quote again, and she says, the quality of our lives is directly related to the quality of our relationships. So many of us grew up in households where the quality of our lives was determined by the assets that we have, was determined by the accomplishments, was determined by the accolades, determined by the bank account, determined by the house, the car. And in actuality, it reminds me of when Kanye was talking to In Drink Champs, and he was saying, you know, not living in a house, not having clothes on his back, and being able to travel to a distant land, and being able to be clothed because of the connections that he's made, because of the lives that he's impacted. He didn't have to, you know, bring anything with him. He could go somewhere and say, hey, you know, I'm here, help me out. And that help is more than willing to provide whatever assistance he may need. And I think that is such a great example of how relationships in your life can help improve your life, and not needing, even though he does have the material success, it's not needed to have a fulfilling life. It's not needed as much as people are needed. I saved this one for last because it's something that I know I struggle with. And as I listen to this podcast back, I'm really excited to listen to all of them. And I know this last one's going to kind of give me a pang in my heart because it is something that's really, really difficult for me. I'll read it. It says, even small acts of forgiveness contribute to one's sense of trust in oneself and the potential of others. They contribute to a human spirit that is fundamentally hopeful and optimistic rather than pessimistic or defeated. They contribute to knowing oneself and others as potentially powerful people who can choose to lovingly create versus seeing humans as basically selfish, destructive, and sinners. That really hit home for me because of how I've been treated, right? Because of how I grew up, because of what I've seen, it is really, really difficult for me to see the good without seeing the possible not good, right? So when someone says, oh, yeah, hey, you know, I got to go leave because my blah, blah, blah is doing this and the third, there is a belief, there is a trust, but there's also a skepticism that's there. And it's been there for a long time. Not really sure when it started, but it's definitely something that I acknowledge. And this excerpt is telling me that you don't have to be blind with your trust or blind with your understanding or faith in others, but you definitely have to choose, right? Choosing forgiveness versus choosing to harp on what's happened to you. Choosing to give the benefit of the doubt. Choosing to be trusting until your trust is betrayed versus someone earning your trust little by little. I think that there's a value to both, but it is said you cannot truly make friends without being vulnerable. And I think that the same is true when it comes to love. You cannot be a loving partner without being vulnerable to whoever you're in a loving dyad with. It doesn't necessarily have to be a significant other. It could be a parent, could be a teacher, could be a colleague, could be a really good friend. All of these people need, at one point or another, will most likely need to be forgiven for something or another, even if they don't know it. That forgiveness is for you more so than it's for them. Being able to say, hey, you know what? Despite the fact that this felt like a betrayal, I am going to give you more rope to whip me with. I'm going to give you more chances to, improve the overall relationship score, right? If a betrayal has brought the relationship down in one way or the other, then having that forgiveness, having that ability to say, hey, you know what, I forgive, it doesn't mean you forget, but it does mean that I want to move on loving you as the person that I think you are, the person that I see the potential in, or the person that I'm enjoying being around and with. I think it's super important for us to do that, for us to practice that forgiveness for our own sake, for our own mental health, for our own attitudes towards others. Because by not forgiving, you just become more and more paranoid, right? You become more unsure of other people's intentions. You become a little bit more skeptical about how people are and what they're doing and whether they really, you know, mean what they say and do what they mean. Or believe what they mean, or mean what they, yeah, whatever that means. But in all actuality, that's tough. That's tough. Because for me, I don't know too many kids who have to forgive their parents for forsaking them. I don't know too many kids that have to forgive their significant others for some betrayal. Especially, when the other party refuses to take accountability. I think that's the hardest part. Forgiveness does come. Forgiveness is possible. But forgiveness when the other person is not being accountable, you're a better person than me. I am in progress still. That is something that I look forward to achieving. And that comes with a sense of self that, you know, cannot be shaken. that comes with a sense of self that's a little bit more trusting. That comes with a sense of self that leads with the heart and not with the head. That comes with a sense of self that understands the value of love, right? You can lead with the head when it comes to understanding, that understands the value of love and is looking to proceed with that value. They are looking to increase as much as they can the presence and the connection with love versus trying to reduce the pain from betrayal. Because when you do, you block off those potential people or situations access to your feelings. You are also blocking love. You're blocking growth. You're blocking that development. And one doesn't come with the other. You know, joy doesn't come with pain. Sunshine doesn't come without rain. Joy doesn't come without, pain. And sunshine doesn't come without rain. And I think these are really important things to consider when it comes to our lives, when it comes to our loves, when it comes to the things that we want to do and carry out, especially as we get older and we are here to shepherd the generation that's coming after us. Learning from the heart, listening from the heart, and acting from the heart are going to be extremely important when it comes to cultivating the love that we want in our lives, because we deserve that love, but we do have to work for it. And that work is encompassed in this book, All About Love. That concludes the 22 anniversary wrap-up of All About Love by Bell Hooks. I think that this book still rings true to me when it is a great book. It is a book that I will be reading every couple of years. It's a book that I found so prolific that I mailed off to my mother, actually. Like, I mailed that book to her because I wanted it to be a point that we could explore each other's pain and histories from, right? I want it to be something that we can say, hey, you know what? Let us gather around the notes in this book and let's put our own experiences and lives in our conversation. And, you know, maybe one day that'll happen. But for now, I am happy to share what I've learned from this book with you, my audience. And I look forward to when we can chop it up together and talk about this book, maybe in 2 years, 5 years, 6 months from now, because this is just one of those books where I know the more I pick it up, the more I learn about myself, the more I learn about my history, and the more I learn about what affects me negatively and positively, right? It's not just about, you know, it's not just about victimhood. It's not just about what you lack, but it's really, really important to know how to get what you want and where to be, how to be trusting, how to be led by the heart more. And I look forward to growing with you with that. Make sure you comment on this episode if you liked what you're hearing. If you have any ideas or excerpts that I may have missed or looked over, please include them in the show notes. Not the show notes. Please include them in your response, your reply. And I really look forward to, I don't know, having a book club, just maybe even a Twitter thread of all these important notes that I really enjoyed from All About Love. As always, you're listening to the Small Chops Podcast. You can find us at effable.co, effable.co. That is also our name on Instagram, effable.co. Name on Twitter is effable, effable. Thank you for being with me. I hope this was something that you learned from. I hope, again, this piqued your interest into investing in this book. And I look forward to kind of breaking down her other books, because there's a trilogy, as I just recently learned, that started with All About Love, and ended with, I think it's called Communion. Maybe there's another book there. But I definitely will be digging into those books in the near future. And stay tuned. Talk to you soon.